As Peter mentioned, Pastor Steve's on vacation right now. He's been doing a series for the past several weeks in partnership with the youth, not the youth. I work in youth ministry, so everything's about youth for me. Pastor Steve's been working with the Kids Zone, and they've been doing a series on unsung heroes of the Bible. And this week, we get to learn about Hannah, who's an amazing woman, and I'm really excited that he asked me to speak about her, because there is a lot to be learned about the way Hannah approached hard times. I don't know if I introduced myself. I'm Karen, and I am the youth pastor for Edgewater, and I work with a really great team of people. If you didn't know, the youth ministry here works in conjunction with another church in Antioch called Hillside Church, and I feel really excited that the Hillside youth leaders are also here this morning, Cindy and Jacob. We all work together, and it's a beautiful partnership. Our Kids Zone has also done things with Hillside, and we're very fortunate to have this relationship with other members of the community who love people as much as we do. So Hannah teaches us a lot, and it's important to not just skim through. You can read about her in the book of 1 Samuel in the Bible, and it's easy to kind of skim through and not really dig in and see what there is to be learned. Before I got married, my mom asked me a question. She told me to think about the one thing that drove me the most crazy about my fiancé. My fiancé's name was Ezra. She told me, imagine that one thing that drives me the absolute most crazy, and imagine living with that for the rest of my life. She said, I'm not saying that people can't change. People can change, but you can't go into a marriage relationship expecting somebody to change. She asked me if the great things that I loved about him would outweigh that one thing that drove me the most crazy. So I decided that everything about him was really well worth it. And I'm so glad that my mom had me think long and hard about that thing, because it is still the thing that challenges me most about Ezra 19 and a half years later. He and I operate at very different paces. He is methodical, he is thorough, and he does things at a much slower pace than I prefer. I spend a lot of time waiting, and I am not good at waiting. He's not the only person in my life that challenges me in this capacity. I have friends who always run late. You all have that one friend. Maybe you are that one friend. If you work with kids, if you have kids, if you babysit kids, if you're an aunt, you're an uncle, you know that there's always a lost shoe. There's always missing homework, one more round on a video game, or just plain stubbornness, or when it's bedtime, everybody gets thirsty, or I have to tell you this, or I have this really long dream that happened 5 nights ago that I have to tell you every detail about because it's bedtime and I just can't go to bed. There's a lot of that in my house. I have five kids, so there's a lot of multipliers there. Most importantly, my greatest challenges in learning to wait, they don't come from people, they come from God. Hannah was a woman who has a lot to teach us about waiting. And she teaches us a lot, not just about waiting, but what we need to do in between. 1 Samuel tells us about a man named Elkanah. I'm sorry if I pronounce things differently than you. I tried looking up the pronunciations, and I looked up a bunch of different ones, and they all say them differently, so I'm just going with how I read it in my head. 1 Samuel tells us about a man named Elkanah. In verse 2, we read, he had two wives. One was called Hannah, and the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Polygamy it occurs in several instances in the Old Testament. I don't believe that this was God's plan. Polygamy was not in God's original design. This is a man-made solution to a societal problem. And one of the problems in that society was that it was, of course, a patriarchal society, and it was very difficult for women to have any sort of support or even survive without having a marriage relationship. If they didn't, they often had to resort to slavery or to prostitution, which also is not God's plan for humanity. Another problem in that society was that often a woman's value was dependent on her ability to have children. God gives clear boundaries in the New Testament about marriage, which people obviously needed because throughout time we've messed things up, right? Anytime we make our own solutions, that's what happens. We mess things up. I do it all the time. It's very apparent in multi-spouse relationships that we read about in the Bible that anytime there's more than one spouse, then there are problems. And Elkanah, he's somebody who valued his family, all of them, both wives. Year after year, we read in verse 3 in 1 Samuel, the man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, Eli was the high priest, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah, to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her and the Lord had closed her womb. There is a lot to be said about Elkanah here. We might like skim over and want to get straight to Hannah, but I think we should mention something about Elkanah. He travels with his whole family. He doesn't go alone. He brings everybody, the kids, his wives, everyone. They all worship together. He makes sacrifices to the Lord, and he gives portions to every member of his family. He doesn't leave anybody out. He is not withholding from anyone. He does, however, give extra to Hannah. I think this says a lot about him. He appreciates both of his wives. He values both of his wives, but his heart belongs to Hannah. She's his favorite. Despite society's value being on a woman's childbearing abilities, he favored Hannah, and he had compassion on her, and he wanted her to know. In verse 6, it says, because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her. Who's her rival? Peninnah, right? The other woman. The rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her until she wept and would not eat. Her husband Elkanah would say to her, Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? So bullying's not a new problem. It's been going on for a long time, right? And in this case, it's actually not too surprising. What's happening? It's easy to look at Peninnah and think that she's just this awful person. She's not just picking on Hannah. She knows what causes her the most pain. She knows what she longs for, what she desires deepest, and she digs at it. She knows the most tender and vulnerable area of her heart. And what does she do? She exposes it. She uses it as a weapon. That is awful. But I imagine Peninnah, I was actually just talking to Miss Diane about this morning. Have you ever heard the phrase, hurt people hurt people? Yeah, so if we think about Peninnah's situation, she's probably hurting. Here she is. She shares a husband with another woman, and the other woman's the favorite. She sees it. She knows it. Peninnah gave him children, but she's still second. And I'm sure that that makes her feel lonely and sad, and like it's unfair. Peninnah takes her hurt, and she picks on Hannah so intensely about the very thing that is the most devastating to Hannah, that Hannah weeps and cannot eat. I don't know if Elkanah, the husband, knows what's going on between the two women. I don't know if he's aware of that dynamic, but I imagine in my mind that it's kind of like on the down low. I'm imagining that Peninnah's kind of taking digs at her in ways that he's not seeing, and I'm also imagining that Hannah's actually not saying anything about it. He's distressed seeing that Hannah's so upset, and he wants to comfort her. Remembering the high value placed on having children, particularly sons, it's worth noting that he's trying to assure her that he values her and that he loves her, and he wants her to see their relationship is more of more value than bearing children, which is saying a lot about him because God is giver of life. And I think that Elkanah recognizes that it's not about the children, it's about our relationship first, and I love you. And he's assuring her it's not about whether or not you can give me children. This is not a transactional love. I love you. And it's a great reassurance that he's offering her. Despite the attacks that Penina launches, there's no record of Hannah lashing out. We read about Penina's relentless bullying, but nothing of Hannah firing back. This is her response. We read about it in verses 9 through 18. Once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli, the priest, was sitting on his chair at the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And she made a vow, saying, Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine. Not so, my Lord, Hannah replied. I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I've been praying here out of my great anguish and grief. Hannah does not attack back. She doesn't isolate herself. She doesn't run away. She doesn't hide from God. She runs to God. Her answer to these attacks and her hurt and her pain is to pray. She's a woman that understands that her ultimate fulfillment does not come from a person. Her ultimate fulfillment does not come from her husband. Her ultimate fulfillment comes from God. We have people in our life that we can confide in. We can run to them. We can seek comfort from others. We can cry with people, but nobody has the strength or authority that God does. Cast all your cares on him, for he cares for you. Hannah understands that God is God. She pours her heart out, and she weeps bitterly before the Lord. At this point, Hannah had been longing for a son for a long time. We read that she was being provoked by her rival year after year. This is not a new situation that she's in. But something was different about her prayer this time. This time, we read in verse 11, she made a vow. She promised to give her son to the Lord and that no razor would touch his head. This is in reference to a Nazirite vow. If you're interested in reading more about what that vow entails, you can read about it in Numbers chapter 6, and it's interesting. Hannah promised her son to God. That's this vow that she made, and that's what it's alluding to. She promises her son to God. She chooses to give her son to God if God should choose to give her a son. She still realizes and acknowledges that this is in his hands, not hers. But this is the promise she makes. And in her anguish, the head priest Eli mistakes her for being drunk. Can you imagine? Like, this woman has been longing desperately for a baby. In her deepest desperation and pain, she's being tormented by another jealous woman who has had children, and not just with anyone, with her husband. And there she is, completely broken. Can this woman catch a break? At her lowest place, she's at her lowest place, and she's accused of being drunk by the head priest. She, at this point, so I'm the type of person in my impatience would be like, okay, look, here's the thing. Slow your roll. You are wrong. This is not the situation. But that's not how Hannah responds. She explains herself. She explains that she is, in fact, not drunk, that she wasn't praying for everyone to hear, that she was praying, in verse 13, in her heart. Her heart is the place where she most wanted God to rescue her, to heal her, to provide for her. She tells Eli that she is a woman who is deeply troubled and that she's pouring out her soul to the Lord. I think Eli had compassion on her at that moment. I think he realized what he was seeing and what was happening in that moment. His response in verse 17 is, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him. She said, may your servant find favor in your eyes. Then she went on her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Her face is no longer downcast, and she regains her appetite. What just happened? Hannah left Eli's presence, believing what Eli had said. He said, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant what you have asked for." She believed it would happen. So the next day, the family gets up, they leave Shiloh, they start on their way back home, they get home. What happens there? Things heat up. We already know that Hannah is Elkanah's favorite. Things get hot. And we read on that Hannah becomes pregnant and she has a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked the Lord for him." So then when the time comes again for Elkanah to take the family back up to Shiloh for their annual time of worship and sacrifice, he was prepared to take the baby because he knows of his wife's vow. She knows of her vow. And Hannah tells him that she would bring him once he was weaned. We don't know the exact age, but usually children would nurse until they were about 3 or 4 years old. So we can guess this is not a baby. This is a young preschool age child. Elkanah was a smart man when she tells him, we'll take the child when he's weaned. And his response, knowing who Hannah is, because I think we've gotten enough evidence to see what kind of husband Elkanah is, he knows his wife, and I think he's seen her dedication to God, and he's seen her fervent desire to please God and to give to God, and that her heart is in the right place. So he responds to her, "Do what seems best to you." He knows that she's on point when it comes to her dedication and loyalty to the Lord. So there's no reason to argue or question what she's saying about when the time would be right to bring him. And sure enough, in verses 24 through 28, we read that Hannah brings Samuel to the house of the Lord along with other items. And upon seeing Eli, the high priest, she reminds him of who she is. We read in verse 26 through 28, she says, "Pardon me, my Lord, as surely as you live, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord," keeping in mind it's probably been a couple of years. "I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord, for his whole life will be given over to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. Can you imagine how hard that would be? Like, we're thinking, okay, this is the conclusion. She made the vow. She brings them. It's easy to kind of read it like it's a story, but these are real people that really existed, and this is a real child that this woman really wanted, and now she's handing him over to fulfill the vow that she made. It doesn't mean she'll never see him again, but she's not going to live with him, and she's not going to be the one raising him. He's going to be raised by Eli, the head priest. She pleaded with God for this boy, and she waited for years to have him. And here she is giving him up. What she wanted so desperately she got, but not for keeps. I can't imagine that I would be in a place where I'd feel like rejoicing in the time where I'd be handing my son over and saying, "All right, somebody, he's in somebody else's hands." That's some serious trust. But Hannah leaves us this amazing example of a heartfelt praise and a response to God's answer to her years and years of pleas. "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord, my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies." I'm kind of imagining right now that, like, Penina's here hearing her praise, and she's like, "My mouth boasts over my enemies. For I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one beside you. There is no rock like our God." Here it is again. "Do not keep talking so proudly, or let your mouth speak such arrogance. For the Lord is God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who were full hired themselves out for food, but those who were hungry are hungry no more. She who was barren has borne 7 children, but she who has had many sons pines away. The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and he raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. For the foundations of the earth are the Lord's. On them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. This woman is excited. She is grateful that she was even given the opportunity to hand this boy over to God. She has real perspective. It's hard, I think, on this earth. We see everything has a beginning and an end. And we love our children so wholeheartedly, it's hard to imagine just handing them over and trusting God with them. It's a difficult task, but Hannah sees the big picture. She sees that there is not just a beginning and an end, this short timeline that we're here. She sees all of it. And she realizes, again, that God is God. A few other stories in the Bible talk about barren women being told that they would have a baby. But they doubted the possibility in that moment. We don't see that with Hannah. She pleaded year after year. She suffered bullying. And the moment that Eli the priest said, "May God grant you what you have asked of him," she believed. Why does God make us wait? And why is it so hard? Over the course of the story, I think that something else can easily go unnoticed. Hannah was an incredible woman with an unwavering faith in God. For years, she asked for a son, but the answer was no. Sometimes when we ask God for things, the answer is a simple no. We're not going to get it. That is not for you. Sometimes I like to lay my plans out before God and be like, "Could you just make this happen? This is what I would like, and I'm pretty sure I have the best thing in mind." And sometimes he's like, "Yeah, no, you don't know. You have no idea." And it's hard for me to trust that God knows better than me. I guess there's a little bit of type A personality in there that comes out when it comes to planning. For years, she asked for a son, but the answer was no. But sometimes there's complexity to the no. When Hannah was weeping bitterly and pouring out her soul and praying in her heart, she made this vow to God. Had she become pregnant early on in her marriage, she likely would have never come to this place. Her and Elkanah probably would have had children, and they would have just gone on with their lives. And of course, she would have still been an incredible woman who honored and loved God, but we wouldn't have heard much about her story. She would have been like an average family there. But something happened when she made that vow to God. And that vow may not have happened if she had not had to wait. God wanted her to be ready for his plan. Her son, Samuel, became a prophet. And Samuel had a profound impact on Israelite history. What do you do when you're told to wait? In your frustration, do you run from God or do you run to God? Waiting isn't fun. Waiting isn't easy. But if we're willing to take our times of anguish, our times of frustration, our times of grief and overwhelming sadness, loneliness, loss, and go to God in prayer, he will hear us. Her story does not just apply to barren women. This is a story for all of us. Maybe you're waiting for that job. Maybe you're waiting for that phone call. Maybe you're waiting for that relationship. Maybe you're waiting to get a dog. I waited for a few years to get a dog, and I was told no for a long time. I have a dog now. But sometimes waiting produces something new inside of us. And if we run from God, we're not going to be able to grow and change in the way that he's waiting to grow and change us. The challenges I face in waiting aren't getting easier with time. I might be getting a little better at it. My response might improve, but they don't get easier. I feel like I get better at one thing, and then I find myself waiting for the next thing, the harder thing, the more painful thing. I said the greatest challenges I face come from God, not people. I recently lost my mom, many of you know. The most difficult struggle I face in waiting now is to see her again. Hannah showed us how to respond to waiting and the torment that you face in between. I say this to you this morning, and I say it to myself also. Actually, no. God says to us this morning, all of us, And I need to be reminded often, especially in this new phase in my life where I'm learning a new kind of waiting. Stop carrying the weight of your stress and pain. That thing that you feel like you need or you want so desperately, stop carrying it on your shoulders. Hannah showed us a way that this is supposed to be dealt with. We're supposed to hand them over to the strength and the power of the one who created you. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for this incredible woman who dedicated her heart to you long before she had children. I praise you and thank you for the role model that she set for all of us. And I just pray for every heart in this room, Lord, for every longing, for every hurt, for every loss, the grief that people are feeling. God, I know for some of the young people, they feel like they can't compare it to the loss of a loved one or, being barren or losing a child, God. But every loss, every form of grief, God, you feel our hurts, and we cannot downplay them or pretend like they don't matter, because they do. If it matters to us, God, it matters to you. And I just pray for the heaviness that any heart feels right now this morning, God, that you would send your spirit and that you would send a peace that passes understanding. And God, that we could lean on you, we could pour our hearts into you, and that we wouldn't feel embarrassed to weep bitterly before you, God, that we would give ourselves fully to you, and whatever that thing is that you're waiting for us to come to, if there's a change that needs to happen in our hearts or in our minds, God, bring us there quickly so we don't have to keep waiting. Lord, I pray that whatever changes need to happen inside of us, that you would open us up to that and that you would reveal them to us, and that we could belong more fully, more completely to you. Because I know that you want all of us, and I pray that you would teach us to not withhold. And I just praise you, and I ask for your blessings on each person in this room, for our children, Lord, our teens, for our community, every life that is represented here and every life that is touched by every life represented here, God. I just pray that you would open your floodgates and pour out your blessings. In your name I pray, amen.